This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There's plenty of time left for you procrastinators out there. Retail to the bitter end, if you must. We'll tell you more about that. Wall Street goes to the movies, or maybe vice versa. I don't know. And banks go to Amish country on the broadcast today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. Marketplace is a nonprofit listener-supported service. To keep our coverage strong and relevant, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount helps us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for December the 24th, Tuesday. Great, as always, to have you with us. And for those of us who haven't finished our Christmas shopping yet, yours truly included, there's still a good 12 hours or more until the rubber meets the road. And Retail America is here to help us out, eagerly, I might add. Toys R Us has kept some of its stores open 24 hours a day since Saturday. The flagship store in Times Square has been open 24/7 since December the 1st. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour explains why.
I'm here in front of the Toys R Us in Times Square. It is 1 a.m., the night before Christmas Eve. You could not tell it is 1 a.m. It is as packed as you would think it would be at noon. And I'm told it is going to stay this busy until 4 a.m.
I picked up some new Crayola crayons for my daughter so she could do some coloring.
Romeo Thomas is shopping for his four-year-old.
I'm out here 1 a.m. because I'm always a late shopper. I procrastinate a lot because I really don't know what I want.
It's not that there are more procrastinators this year. It's that there was actually less time.
There were fewer shopping days between Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Teresa Williams is professor of marketing at the Kelly School of Business. She says there were six fewer shopping days this year because Thanksgiving came so late. On top of all that, Williams says, Toys R Us has an extra challenge this year.
They didn't feel that there was a must-have toy this year.
But this isn't just a Toys R Us thing. Kohl's, Kmart, and Target, among others, have extended hours, too. Kathy Granis is with the National Retail Federation. She says the holiday season accounts for 40% of some retailers' revenue.
Consumers have indicated that they plan to spend less this year on holiday gifts. And so the economy has certainly put retailers in a mode where they have to compete. And these longer hours are certainly one of the ways that they look to compete.
Of course, being open longer means someone has to work longer. Andrew Hardwick created a petition several years ago to ask Target to reconsider opening on Thanksgiving Day for the sake of its employees.
It's really upsetting that we've reached a certain level in this country where if you are a low-wage worker at one of these jobs, our society has said you don't deserve a holiday.
But Williams at the Kelly School says many people she's spoken to haven't minded.
Most of these hours are filled by part-time. For the folks that I talked to, they were grateful to have more payroll in their pockets at this time.
The shopping marathon is coming to an end tonight. Toys R Us is closing at 10 p.m. I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
8 months ago, the 24th of April to be precise, a clothing factory in Bangladesh collapsed. 1,100 people were killed. It's been called the deadliest incident in the history of that industry. There is news today. The families of those workers are going to get some financial help. Four of the retailers that bought from the factory have helped set up a fund that will pay out an average of $25,000 per household. Marketplace's Dan Weissman looks at what that'll mean in a country where the per capita income is about $1,900 a year.
First, if $1,900 sounds incredibly low to you, then Scott Nova has news. That's actually a lot more than the victims were making.
The workers who were killed were making on average around $600 or $700 per year.
He's the director of Workers' Rights Consortium, and he says Bangladesh has the world's lowest wages for garment workers. So does that make a $25,000 payout sound more reasonable?
Obviously, it means a lot more there than it does here. At the same time, it's obviously not going to make anybody wealthy, even in the Bangladesh context.
Especially because it's going to be paid out over the lifetime of survivors. Essentially, every year the families will get about half of what the worker would have earned. The U.S. government has several calculators that peg the value of a human life here. They start at $6 million. And what if you were just taking out a life insurance policy?
They tend to say that an individual should have 7 to 10 times their income in coverage.
That's Jack Dolan from the American Council of Life Insurers. He's citing figures from the financial planning industry.
It's so hard, and some people would say almost pointless, to compare the United States to Bangladesh.
That's Brad Adams. He looks at Asian countries for Human Rights Watch. In the U.S., he points out, if your boss's building fell down on you, your family would expect to be compensated.
In Bangladesh, there's no such protections. People are really in it all by themselves.
The companies involved in this agreement are all contributing voluntarily. Several big U.S. brands did business with the factory: Walmart, Children's Place, JCPenney, Sears. At this point, none of them have volunteered to kick in anything. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a short session, but new records nonetheless. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Russia had an early treat for Ukraine today, Christmas present-wise. The first $3 billion of a $15 billion bailout that the Kremlin promised last week. It'll help stabilize the Ukrainian economy, if not necessarily the government there. Somewhere near 100,000 pro-European protesters took to the streets of the capital Kiev this past weekend. But in the rural parts of that country, where people rely more on Russian trade, a lot of people say there is only one choice for their future. The BBC's Steve Rosenberg reports from Lugansk.
When I arrive in Lugansk, I see no barricades, no pro-Europe protest camps. What I do see makes me think I'm back in the USSR. As I walk around the town, I count four Lenin statues. I stroll down Soviet Street and Young Communist Lane. All the street signs and the shop fronts are in Russian. But then Russia is close by. The EU feels very distant. At the Lugansk locomotive factory, they're looking east, not west. That's hardly surprising when you consider who buys all their trains. Pavel Tsesnik is the general director.
My factory is practically 100% dependent on the Russian market because all our production goes to Russian railways, and this is the only our customer we have.
And what about in general in eastern Ukraine? How reliant are enterprises on Russia?
From economical point of view, the Russian market is, for all of us, critical.
As I'm leaving the factory, one of the workers, Vladimir, comes up to me and asks, what's Europe playing at? Did you know, Vladimir says, that the same group which destroyed the Lenin statue in Kiev also shouts, down with Jews and Russians? They're fascists. But for some reason, Europe calls this democracy. Where's your sense of morality? Why is Europe so blind? At the little bread shop down the road, they've just delivered a batch of freshly baked loaves. And pensioner Valentina Semyonova is queuing up for hers. I ask Valentina what she thinks of the anti-government protests in the capital. She fears that closer ties with the EU would raise prices and make her life harder.
Those
protesters are fools, Valentina says. If I was president, I'd chase them off the square and unite Ukraine with Russia and with Putin. The EU would just milk us for all we have. We'd get nothing in return. Not everyone in Lugansk is anti-Europe. I witnessed this argument on the street, where the council is recruiting volunteers to go to Kiev to support President Yanukovych. One passerby accuses the people signing up of doing it for money. She backs the protesters, but she's a minority in this town. There are many here who deeply resent the pro-Europe protesters in Kiev and in western Ukraine. Alexander is a shop assistant. I think that the three regions of eastern Ukraine, Lugansk, Donetsk and Kharkov, should break away from all those nationalists in the west of the country, Alexei tells me. Put up a border, make ourselves a separate country. And if I could afford it, I'd go to Kiev and help the riot police put down that revolution. Those protesters should be put to work down the coal mines. I tell Alexei that what he's suggesting, splitting Ukraine, sounds like a new kind of Berlin Wall. He shrugs his shoulders. Well, we'll be fine in the east, he assures me. We've got all the industry, all the coal. Everyone else is living at our expense.
I'm the BBC's Steve Rosenberg for Marketplace.
Markets will be closed tomorrow, but Wall Street will be at work nonetheless at the local Cineplex. Martin Scorsese's latest, The Wolf of Wall Street, opens Leonardo DiCaprio in the title role, as you might have heard. The storyline will be familiar, hard-partying brokers making a killing off shady deals, which, too soon, after the financial crisis? I don't know. Wesley Morris writes about movies for Grantland. Wesley, good to have you back.
Nice to be here.
Here we are now, Wesley, what, five-something years after the crisis. Is it okay now to laugh and I guess, be entertained by Wall Street and, you know, this movie?
I think so, depending on how the tone you take in the laughter. I think if you are making a farce the way Scorsese has, you make a pretty good case for finding something funny and something that is inherently kind of tragic.
Do you think Scorsese's actually turned this thing into a farce? I mean, because this was a crazy story, right? This guy goes out and gets penny stocks and gets rich off them, and here now he's Leonardo DiCaprio, for crying out loud.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's two things for me that mitigate the what might otherwise be appalling. One, the first of which is that there's no romance or glorification in this story. And I think Scorsese, as a New Yorker, sort of feels like there's something disgusting and infuriating about a lot of the roots of the crisis being rooted in a place that he's from. But the movie itself makes that world into such a circus that there's no way in the world one could hope to emulate it. Only a psychopath would leave the film and want to.
Well, all right. So okay. So without casting aspersions on Wall Street, I read a lot of financial blogs. My Twitter feed is full of financial people, and from people who have seen this movie, even though it doesn't open for a couple of days, apparently the Wall Street types sit in there and they go, you know, and you're like, come on, really?
Yeah, that does not surprise me. I mean, one of the funny things. I mean, look at Wall Street, for instance, a movie that is inarguably
Wall Street the movie, right? Gordon Gekko, Greed.
Wall Street
good,
the movie, yes, inarguably anti-capitalist, or at least anti-Wall Street, but people quote it, and it's a kind of recruitment tool for people into that world. I think there is a way in which, and the movie sort of gets into this a little bit too, there is no vilification or demonization that can keep people who are inherently drawn to that world, and not just money or finance, but this particularly corrupt strain
right,
of it.
Right. Did you like it? Was it a good film? I mean, it's long, right?
It's like
3 hours.
I love the movie. But you know what? I've seen it twice now. It flies.
Really?
It's the funniest movie he's made.
Funny like ha-ha or funny like...
I mean, it's ha-ha funny. There's some weird stuff in it, but mostly it is laugh-out-loud funny. And there's just ridiculous things that get at the extravagance of Belfort's world. You know, the idea that he had a helicopter pad on top of his yacht, for instance.
Right, Jordan Belfort, the guy about whom the film was made.
Yes.
All right, now I'm going to have to go see it. Wesley Morris, he writes on films.
Were you not going to go?
I was going to pass because I live in Wall Street, and who needs to, you know, I mean, get me away from that stuff in my off hours. You know?
I'd be curious to know how you feel about it.
All right, I'll let you know. Wesley Morris, he writes on films at Grantland. We'll see you, man.
Thanks, Kai. Happy, merry everything.
Yeah, you too. Bye-bye. Coming up.
There was one year one of my aunts made a birthday cake that said Happy Birthday, Gordon and Jesus. And I thought that was a little awkward.
Yeah, a little bit. But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street closed early today for the holiday, but not before setting more records. The Dow Industrials added a third percent, 62 points, closed at 16,357. Yes, a record. The S&P 500 pulled in a quarter percent, 5 points, ended at another record, 1833. The NASDAQ up a tenth percent, 6 points, finished at 4155. Twitter unwrapped an early gift. Its shares climbed more than 8% today, pushed the stock price up near $70 a pop. Its IPO price last month, just by the by, $26. Microsoft clicked up 1.25%, thanks in part to all those Xboxes that are going to be open tomorrow. Not, by the way, at my house, kids, if you are listening. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.98%. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is listener-supported. To keep our coverage relevant and compelling, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount supports your daily dose of business insight from Marketplace. So please help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. It's that time of year. Yep, the famous Delaware crossing of George Washington happened in 1776. And of course, it's Christmas. That means the stock markets are closed for the day, just in time to tear the wrapping off those presents. And it's a lot of gift wrap. Americans spend $2.6 billion annually to use it and shred it to pieces. Enjoy the holiday. I'm Denise Guerra.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Twitter was the biggie, as I mentioned in the numbers, but this was quite the year for companies going public. Everything from the Container Store to Norwegian Cruise Lines went to the markets. And while not all of them are home runs, IPOs can bring big money to early employees, on paper at least, which can make things a little bit awkward this time of year as certain friends and family members raise their gifting expectations. Marketplace's Mark Garrison explains.
Strike it rich with an IPO and suddenly everyone thinks you're Santa Claus.
You find you have relatives and friends you never knew you had.
Doug Wolford is president of Convergent Wealth Advisors. He says some people ask for serious stocking stuffers.
I've known people whose friends have, you know, asked them to pay off their cars, take them on trips to the Super Bowl, you name it.
Luxury Institute CEO Milton Pedraza says some pressure to spend big is internal.
The individuals themselves begin to feel guilty, feel like they do have to step in and solve a lot of the problems for the people they love. So it's kind of a two-sided issue.
Many newly wealthy overspend early, then regret it when they get the biggest tax bill of their life. Or they don't realize IPO wealth isn't automatic. There are limits on how soon they can cash stock in, and the price might drop before they do. Susan Bradley runs the Sudden Money Institute.
The first year is the toughest year. After that, you can make a plan, and you have months to put the plan into effect.
As for folks pushing for Lux presents, a polite no is good manners and good financial planning. Lizzie Post is the great-great-granddaughter of etiquette legend Emily Post.
You shouldn't feel pressured to all of a sudden have to buy everyone, you know, a $500 gift, whereas you used to buy them a $30 gift. I mean, that's just not, it's just not right. I'm going to just say it. It's just not right.
She says good friends should treat a new millionaire the same way as before the payday. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
The past 5 years have not been glorious ones for the American banking industry. 5.5 or 6 years, really. The crisis, the crash, the aftermath. There are new regulations, new oversight in Washington, a wary public eye. All of which is to say the banking business, at least for smaller banks, hasn't been all that attractive. In fact, no new banks opened in 2011 or 2012. Or 2013, even until just a couple of weeks ago, which prompted Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith to pay a visit to the newest.
Hi there. Welcome to Bank of Bird in Hand. Can I help you?
The Bank of Bird in Hand sits at a remote intersection in Bird in Hand, Pennsylvania. There's an empty field next to it, and across the street from it, there's a farmer's market down the road. The bank itself is housed in an old stone home that used to be a doctor's office.
My office was the waiting room.
Bill O'Brien is the bank's chief loan officer.
If you needed to give a sample or a specimen, you went in the bathroom here, but now it's our vault.
The bathroom vault isn't the bank's most unique feature, though. That's out in the parking lot.
Well, we're looking at the horse shed. Nice place for them to park their horse and buggy to come into the bank.
Bird in Hand is in the heart of Amish country. Here, buses full of tourists and trucks loaded down with locally grown corn, eggs, and tobacco share the highway with horse-drawn Amish buggies. The local economy is strong. This is one of the most productive agricultural areas in the country. There's a thriving tourist trade and a lot of small businesses. Seems like the ideal place to open a bank. But this isn't the ideal time to open a bank.
When I was asked to come and meet with them, I came with the idea that I was going to talk about it, doing it.
That's banking industry veteran Brent Peters. He's now the CEO of the Bank of Bird in Hand. But when he first met with organizers, he was a skeptic. He felt like the deck was stacked against small banks. Hundreds have closed their doors over the last few years, and we now have fewer banks than at any time in U.S. history.
Really, the environment was not friendly towards banking. The regulations were changing constantly. The cost of implementing those new regulations, there was no differential between a Bank of America or Bank of Bird in Hand.
Peters became a convert when he saw how much support there was for the bank. They were able to raise $17 million all locally. Banking consultant Ken Thomas says he's not surprised by that support.
Community banks, because they're more in touch with their communities, are more apt to make the small business loans and farm loans that we need.
In fact, they make nearly half of those loans. Meanwhile, big banks are closing a lot of their rural branches. I spoke to one of Bird in Hand's Amish customers. Members of the Amish community won't be identified on tape because it goes against their values of modesty and humility. But anonymously, he told me having a bank was a really big deal to the community.
With the lending officers understanding the people locally, understanding the history of families, how it gets handed from one generation to the next, that is important to us, yeah.
Lending officer Bill O'Brien says to make agricultural lending work, you have to understand agriculture. And to make it work in Amish country, you have to understand Amish culture.
We have a saying that when you want to go out and see an Amishman, you got to go see him. But if he wants to see you, you still got to go see him. So that's sort of how it is here.
O'Brien estimates about half of his business will be Amish. Still, regulations are regulations, and banking consultant Ken Thomas says compliance can cost $250,000 a year. That's not a big deal for Bank of America, but it's a very big deal for the Bank of Bird in Hand. Still, Thomas thinks Bird in Hand will succeed.
The people in Amish country are going to be supporting that bank and basically taking their deposits out of the non-Amish banks, of course, and going to this bank.
Thomas says small banks have an edge on big banks. Loyalty. And if they can tailor service to a community in a way big banks can't, the community can serve them too. In Bird in Hand, Pennsylvania, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
For those who observe, the whole thing about tomorrow, the fundamental mechanism of it, is that it's a birthday. The birthday, really, for a large chunk of humanity. Thing is, lots of people have December 25th on their birth certificates. Marketplace's Adrian Hill sends us off into Christmas Eve.
It's not easy to have a Christmas birthday. Instead of a rousing surprise party and everyone singing for you, you get your neighbor's earnest caroling.
Silent night, holy night.
Or consider this story from Gordon Wishern. He'll be 33 this Christmas Eve.
There was one year where we were together with my aunts and uncles, and one of my aunts made a birthday cake that said, "Happy Birthday, Gordon and Jesus." And I thought that was a little awkward.
When he was little, his mom made the good call of moving his birthday celebration to his half birthday, so he wouldn't have to share with Jesus. And on his actual birthday...
On Christmas Eve, my parents would make whatever I wanted to eat for my birthday. So that was nice.
But Bill Crumbine doesn't even get that. He's going to be 70 this Christmas Day. He recalls one birthday about 20 years ago when he had a simple wish.
I wanted tacos.
Tacos. A modest enough birthday request.
I wanted tacos. And of course, I did not win out. We had our typical turkey dinner.
And he got so frustrated, so annoyed, that he started a website for people with Christmas birthdays to share their feelings.
Christmas time of the year, it can be kind of just glum.
He says it was a big deal when he was a kid.
You can't just invite your friends over on your birthday because people are busy doing other things.
People wrap your gifts in Christmas paper, or worse,
people forget your birthday.
And there's the Christmas birthday curse that you hear from nearly everyone with a holiday birthday.
Sometimes people give combination birthday Christmas presents, so you might get fewer presents.
Less attention, fewer presents. It turns out it's not just whining. Folks with Christmas birthdays may have good reason to feel the way they do.
I don't know anybody who has directly looked at this question.
Josh Ackerman is an MIT professor who studies behavior. His birthday is December 29th. There's no hard data, he says, but there are a few explanations why people might feel this way. Good explanations.
Okay, so the first possibility is that people actually are receiving fewer gifts when their birthdays are closer to Christmas.
The logic is we all have a limited amount of money, and at Christmas time, it goes to Christmas gifts. There's also a possibility, says Ackerman, that a Christmas birthday makes it harder to see birthday presents.
Essentially, people might use what's called a contrast effect when it comes to thinking about their birthday versus Christmas. They might compare the two, and because there's so much focus on Christmas or the holidays, in comparison, their birthday might seem much less important.
Less important and less gifty.
Another possibility is actually something we can term hedonic adaptation.
We adapt to positive experiences. More gifts do not add up to more happiness. At some point, presents just blend together. And people wind up feeling slighted, even if the number of gifts and the size of party are the same. The solution? Make space. Do what Gordon's mom did and move the birthday celebration to a half birthday. And, says advice columnist Amy Dickinson, remember,
a person's birthday is the most important day in their year.
Even more important than Christmas.
If your child's birthday falls on Christmas Eve or Christmas, regardless of what else is going on, you need to sit down with the birthday person, give that person a card, a hug, and say, "You're the most important thing to me today."
Give them their own cake, and if it's what they want, their birthday tacos. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
I got a drum. Me a bicycle just for being born, but I'm only getting half of what I oughta, 'cause my birthday comes on Christmas.
If you or somebody you know is a Christmas baby, boy, have we got a Tumblr for you. We're calling it Santa Stole My Birthday. Check it out on Tumblr or at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which the spirit of the season clearly escapes the government of the United States, specifically the U.S. Postal Service, and yes, I know technically privatized, but roll with me here. Regulators said today that first-class postage is going to go up in the new year, 3 cents to be precise, or 6.5%. 49 cents, almost a half a buck, is what you're going to have to pay for a forever stamp starting January the 26th. So, hey, mail your thank you notes early, will you? All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM this Christmas Eve. Today, the Dow up a 3rd percent, 62 points. The NASDAQ gained a 10th percent, 6 points. The S&P 500 pulled in a 0.25%. That's about 5 points. Nancy Fargali and John Ketchum are the producers on our Marketplace desks. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you back here tomorrow. Well, not we, me. I'm off. David Gurr is going to be here. Take it easy. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.